We're running a smidgen late here. Those of you who are across the hall with me, thank you for your patience. I realize I lost some in process, but I picked up a bunch of others. And unless you're here for Dr. McKeel's presentation, which is across the way. So if you came to hear Dr. McKeel, he's over there. But I'd be happy for you to stay with me, assuming the projector works. Brother Pfeiffer over here asked a question just now, and I'd meant to say something about this earlier. Some resources that you might find helpful for the entire range of Ezra, Nehemiah, Esther, and so forth. He was asking about a translation of the Cyrus Cylinder, and I really recommend if you can, this set of books is really expensive, but it's very, very good, called Context of Scripture. There are three volumes to this, edited by William Hallow and Kay Lawson Younger. And this is sort of the more modern counterpart of the ancient Near Eastern text by Pritchard. Some of you are familiar with that, although the translation of the Cyrus Cylinder, most of it is at least in Pritchard's book as well, a lot cheaper and easier to access. Nice cheap paperback edition as well. But this has documents from all over the ancient world, particularly the Mesopotamian and Egyptian world, and very well done. This series, this big monster books, are also out in paperback, and they tend to fall apart quick. But I'm sick enough, I have a hardback copy and paperback copy, one here and one at home, because I use them that much. So the Cyrus Cylinder and some other documents that I'll be talking about next session are also translated out of this. A fairly recent production is a series of books called the Zondervan Illustrated Bible Background Commentary on the Old Testament. There's five volumes to this, and the chapters and sections are somewhat uneven, partly depending on the interest and professionalism or the focus, academic focus of the individual, but it does do what it describes. It gives a lot of illustrative background material. It's not a theological commentary. It's putting all the stuff within its social cultural setting. And so this series is also very good. You can buy these individually. They tend to run about $50 a piece retail, but you can inevitably get them for cheaper in other sources. If you need a book on Persia, in my opinion, this is the textbook. Edwin Yamauchi, wonderful, kind gentleman, a believer, teaches at Miami University, PhD from Brandeis, Oriental fellow, but he's a sweet, sweet man and brilliant. And he has written this book called Persia in the Bible. This is put out by Baker. It's a little bit dated now, but his information is still very, very good. And he approaches it from a standpoint of respect to the Bible and so forth. He's not attempting to undermine anything. And the other series, anytime you deal with the Greek world, these Loeb classics are the standard books to have. They're also neat fun to play with. I love the size of these things. They're my size. And but this is Herodotus, Josephus, and I mean, there are hundreds of these with all kinds of authors. They're a little on the expensive side, but if you have a good library, they should have access to these. But they have the Greek text on one side and the English translation on the other. Of course, if you don't care about Greek and Latin, there are other avenues to go. Penguin has publications of these without the Greek and the Latin, but some of us are sick enough that we like to have that. So those are some resources that you might access to pursue some of this. There's some seats right up here in the front. Special. Okay. Wow, I'm in a quandary as to exactly what to do. I'm going to go ahead with the Esther thing. So can we douse the lights that are up toward the front here? The other bank.
Can you give your chronology again?
Ah, yes. I've asked Dr. McLarty, this is the other Dr. McLarty, to print off the copies of the chronology thing, so those are going around. If you didn't get one the last period, please feel free to take one, because this is really going to be important, particularly in this episode and the next one. And so it wasn't quite as critical in the first discussion. Of course, you wouldn't have known that because the pictures didn't work half the time. So, the archaeology of Esther. And this is it's difficult sort of to get your head around some of this because, you know, the archaeology of Esther is a bit of a challenge. But some historical perspective. As an archaeologist, that's something inevitably we attempt to do is try to put things in their historical setting. It is important to realize that the American Revolution did not occur yesterday. And so you've got to have some perspective as to what preceded what and what came afterward. So as we look at this, this is the range, sort of the ultimate range of the Persian Empire. By the way, the set of maps published by, who are they published by? Macmillan? No, not Macmillan. It's down there somewhere. Hammond, I think it is, yeah. Are very, very good. Little detailed, sometimes they're overdone because of that, but still give a good impression of the relief and so forth. But the Persian Empire got to be huge. And inevitably, they get greedy. Now, Darius, or Darius, as some will refer to him, is one of the great kings. He is one of the successors of, there's Cyrus the Great, then Cambyses, and then Darius comes to the throne. Cambyses didn't reign very long. And Darius comes to the throne about 522. I don't have a chronology sheet here. About 522. And this famous, the Behistun stone inscription and image is one of those really, really big things that people were always impressed with. Now, a lot of the early travelers didn't know at all who this was, partly because they couldn't read Akkadian, nor can I, for that matter. Anybody here read Akkadian? Okay, we do have some, a couple of professors on staff that can, but that's not one that I pursued. I know archaeology better than they do. Anyway. But they couldn't read the inscriptions, and one of the interpretations was Jesus with his apostles. And I never quite understood that one because the apostles seemed to be bound. But anyway, this was supposed to be Jesus and his apostles. Now, it might be the case they couldn't see it because this stands way high above the plain. Well, eventually, Rawlinson comes along, and he breaks the code of the Akkadian. And this is in the mid-late 1800s. And now they opens up, sort of like what happened with Champollion and hieroglyphics, it opens up a huge array of literature that can now be used for comparative purposes in studying the Bible. But this is a portrayal in about 518 BC of Cyrus subjugating one of his enemies that was a rival to the throne. And these are representatives of various kingdoms that he has subjugated as well. Now, another portrayal, and this is very similar to what is described both in, that you'll see depicted in Egypt, as well as an allusion to this in the book of Joshua. The king's foot, this is Darius' foot, and a listing of various cities and countries that he has subjugated. And so they're now under the soles of his feet. You'll find this kind of portrayal in the Egyptian literature. Tutankhamun's throne with the footstool has bound subjects that he puts his feet on as he sits on the throne. And of course, there's the reference in the book of Joshua where Joshua, in that southern campaign, gathers the kings together and he tells the leaders of Israel, come put your feet on the necks of these kings. So this is a very common kind of motif in the ancient world. And Darius is doing exactly this kind of thing here. So he's a warrior, and he revels in the warriorness of his character. And of course, he becomes greedy for other territory. Now, part of the issue here is he's ticked at the Greeks, in particular the Athenians, because there was a rebellion over here in the eastern part, or western part of Asia Minor that the Athenians have stirred up and helped sponsor. And so Darius wants to come back and punish the Greeks for their contribution to this international rebellion. And so he brings his army on and there's the great battle of Marathon. The Greeks are horribly outnumbered here. And this is a portrayal that I got off the internet of the battle. The Greeks are the blue, and they weakened the middle part of their line, strengthened the outer part, and when the Persians attacked in the middle, they enveloped them and were able to conquer them. Now, this is the Battle of Marathon, 490 BC. You've heard of this. You should have heard of this. If you haven't heard of it, something's wrong with you. Okay, and you obviously, if you haven't heard of it, you don't keep your ears open to much of anything on the news. Because every year this kind of thing happens, but for other reasons. So the Battle of Marathon was a big deal, and it was, the Greeks really didn't know whether they would win, but they obviously did. And Darius was sort of whipped at this. It is in this setting that there is a run back to Athens to report the victory of the battle. I think this picture's out of order. Here is a portrayal. I didn't have time fully to refine all of this. This is Darius sitting on the throne with his son, Xerxes, otherwise known as Ahasuerus, standing behind him. And this shows some of the intended succession. Now this becomes important, actually this succession becomes important in the dynamic of this, because when Darius is defeated, he is extremely angry at having lost. You know, the ego of the king, if nothing else. And so he wanted to take revenge upon the Greeks, and of course Xerxes is going to take up that mantle. And he's going to carry forth, attempt at least to carry forth with that. Now at the battle at Marathon, this is the tumulus in which the 192 or so Greek soldiers are buried against the 6,000 plus Persians that died. A humiliating differential. It's worse than Harding beating Southern Nazarene University in a football game the other day. 58-0 was the score. At least we won, but this is the kind of differential that characterized this battle. And Darius is just humiliated by this. And so he goes back home, and by the way, Miltiades is the leader of the Greeks. By the way, modern Greeks are not nearly as good at sculpture as the ancient Greeks were. This guy looks really stiff. If you remember anything about ancient Greek statuary, it's much more fluid and everything than this. They've lost their ability. But this is Miltiades standing there saying, you know, no further. You know, that's the symbolism of holding up the hand. Now, Miltiades is a significant leader. And one of the things that he does, well, the report goes from Marathon to Athens by this weird route, partly because there are a lot of mountains here, so they take sort of the easiest route to get to Athens to report this. Most of you are familiar with the story that says Pheidippides, I think his name is, arrives there, full armor, announces we won, and then he dies. And the reason he had to go in full armor was because that showed that we didn't lose. So he got here full armor and he dies. Now, the truthfulness of that story is open to some question. But there's little question that there was some courier who ran back. And it probably is he as well. A lot of armies in the ancient world did have foot couriers who would travel, and you have an allusion to this when Absalom is fighting against David, and Ahimaaz is wanting to run back and tell David that everything's fine. And Joab won't let Ahimaaz do this, and instead the Cushite goes. And then Ahimaaz continues, let me go, let me go, let me go, let me go, and he finally gives him permission, and David sees both of them coming with a message. So these foot couriers are rather common in the ancient world. So this wouldn't be at all a surprise. But the distance here is 26.2 miles, and Sharon and I, well, I'll get to that in a moment. Miltiades then later is going to give to Zeus the helmet that he wore, apparently, in the battle. Now, I don't think we're to infer this is a result of the battle. That would be a crushing headache. Here is a close-up of the chin piece, and you can see an inscription down here, and it says Miltiades on it. And he gives this to Zeus at Olympia, not Mount Olympus, the site of Olympia. He gives this as a token of appreciation to Zeus for the victory at Marathon. Another artifact that is there in the museum at Olympia is a Persian helmet taken by the Greeks from the battle at Marathon, from the Medes, and it's also given as an honorific gesture to Zeus. And there's an inscription from the ancient world of this token appreciation for the victory at Marathon. Sharon and I had the privilege of being there on the 2,500th anniversary of the running of the marathon. And we ran in the marathon about 20 yards. I had to be able to say that. And there's a video of each of us running about 20 yards in the marathon. Now, we actually participated in the 5K. We enjoyed that so much. We just, you know, sort of strolled along, camera, talked to people, take pictures and everything else. We crossed the finish line holding hands and all this. And then all the other hug kids, oh, there's Dr. Manner, Mrs. Manner, you know. We had a great old time there. But the 2,500th anniversary of this event, This is a notable event for Western civilization. Some have suggested that if it were not for this turn of events within this span of 12 or so years, we would be speaking Farsi a long time ago. I'm going to leave the rest of the implication of that alone. Now, again, some of the chronology of the Achaemenids. Cyrus the Great, Cyrus II, 559 to 529, Cambyses, you don't hear much about him. Darius comes to the throne, and the Battle of Marathon takes place in 490. And again, he is as angry as he can be, and he wants to take vengeance on the Greeks for that humiliating defeat at Marathon. 6,000 plus Persians against 192 Greeks. I mean, that is humiliating. But there are problems brewing in Egypt. So he cannot get back to Greece with any speed. He dies in 586, or 486, and his son, Xerxes, also known as Ahasuerus, if you read some of your older versions, comes to the throne in 485. Now, the Bible describes in the book of Esther, chapter 1, verse 3, in the third year of his reign, there's this big party. I refer to it as the party that takes place. And the Bible is quite clear about some of the people that are in attendance. Now, clearly it's a party that is widespread, but look at the statement in Ezra chapter 1, verse 3. It says, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all his officials and servants. The army of Persia and Media and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him. I think it's important to catch the army of Persia and the Medes and the governors. Many have suggested that this big party is part of the planning strategy for the attack against the Greeks. Now, admittedly, the book of Esther doesn't talk about that. But if you look at the chronology and how it unfolds, this plays into this conflict with the Greeks that is going on. Now, the Bible describes that here's Susa. This is where the activities are being conducted. And the Bible describes that there's a lot of drinking going on, a whole lot of drinking going on. A big party, there's a split party that takes place. I'm not going to address the Vashti issue, but it'll talk about this big party, and the text talks about there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fastened with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars, couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, precious stones. Drinks were served in golden vessels, vessels of different kinds, and the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. Some examples of vessels. These are just some that have been discovered in various locations. Pretty well describes what's going on in the text. Now, this is not necessarily all from Susa, but the Persians were really big on, at least the elite, were on this lavishness. And you can imagine vessels similar to this were being involved, particularly in the probably tighter quarters of those, the elite in this party, and so forth. So imagine some of these vessels being involved, not specifically these, being used in that big party. But it was a significant place. Susa Palace is huge. I'm sorry, I meant to put these in different order. Here's a view of the palace. This is a larger view and an isometric view of the palace at Susa. If you get some scale here, this is a 50-meter scale right there. Now, 50 meters is half of 100 yards approximately. So we're looking at a monstrously huge structure here. This was built by Darius and taken over by Xerxes and became sort of the focal point. And it's within the setting of this that all of these events in the book of Esther begin to unfold. The throne room is assumed to be right there. And at the end of the book of Esther, when she is so reticent about going in because of the royal scepter being raised and so forth, he likely is sitting in the throne room back right there, and he sees Esther and, of course, grants her the audience to come in, and she makes her request, "Won't you come to dinner, dear?" And that's a manner of paraphrase. But And he agrees, and things then begin to unfold. But this is the setting within which those events begin to take place. More photographs from this. We're now looking at the gatehouse. Different views of the gatehouse that we have here. And this is an isometric drawing. Again, the scale that is shown here, this is 10 meters, or is it 5 meters, represented there. And Mordecai is at the gatehouse. At the gate, he hears the conspiracy of those who are going to try to put the king to death. And, of course, that sets the scene when the king can't sleep at night, and so he gets the boring congressional record read to him, and that's their counterpart of the congressional record. And he hears this report. Has anything been done for this man who has saved me from this conspiracy? And, of course, that sets the scene. And Haman comes in, and the king asks him, and says, what would I do for somebody who's in whose life I delight and I want to bless? And Haman, being self-centered as he is, thinks, oh, it must be me. And so he gives this explanation of this grand parade through town. He says, great, go do that to Mordecai. And, egg all over his face, humiliated and everything else, and he goes out. But it's the setting of the gatehouse where Mordecai finds out about all of this and apprises Esther, who then lets the conspiracy be made known. These are some of the views of this. This is the Apadana, that is this big columned area here. One of the column bases of the more formal section as you transition from one part of the structure to another. These are pictures that I've taken from other sources. Sadly, I've never been there. I would love to go there, but there are political things that tend to intervene and intrude into this. These are some photographs from, this is from the Louvre, some of the brickwork decoration within the palace. Certainly commensurate with the vessels and the kind of richness and lavishness that the Bible describes. Here's a column. This is actually from Persepolis, but the columns that characterize much of the palace at Susa were very, very similar. And then there's this monstrous bullhead going into a formalized audience with the king, and you can get some idea. The reason I'm in it is just for scale, not because I'm significant, but I want you to see how big the bullhead is. And the massiveness of all this, and these are from the University of Chicago at the Oriental Institute, which, by the way, if you ever go up to Chicago, I really urge you to go to the Oriental Institute Museum. It's a fabulous museum with a lot of biblical kinds of finds that you'll often see in the illustrations. And they actually let you take pictures, too. So it's a wonderful visit. Now, the suggestion is, and this is not unique to me, the suggestion is that Xerxes may have been planning revenge for Darius' loss. And it's within that setting, then, that Vashti is summoned in, and she, of course, refuses to go, and he gets ticked off. And then I really am amazed at the insecurity of his advisors. If our wives get word that the queen has treated the king this way, they'll never listen to us again. And, you got to do something about this. These guys got a real problem. But anyway, all of us know that our wives control us anyway, but... So the setting here is, then finally he heads off on this campaign and he fights against the Greeks in a number of sequences here. Now I want to come back to this. The battle at Thermopylae. Esther is not queen yet, but the search for the queen is going on. By the way, the text will talk about her using myrrh and various ointments and so forth that she chooses in her preparation, and this was open to all of the concubine candidates. I have examples of myrrh granulated, frankincense granulated, and nard, as well as liquid forms of all of those over here. And I urge you to smell them. Don't open the ones that are granulated because they're in a little petri dishes. I'm not growing anything with them, but that's just the way I show them. But the granulated myrrh and frankincense are in the little petri dishes, but I have bottles of myrrh and frankincense and nard, and I urge you to have a smell. I think you'll like the nard better than the other two, but be aware of this is the kind of stuff that people in the ancient world use. And, get all your senses into this endeavor. It's great fun. But the Battle of Thermopylae is another one of those significant turning points. This is a reason I have 300 up here is this is the setting of the movie 300, which I haven't seen, by the way. But I know it's a real popular movie among some and so forth. And it's a really critical battle. The Greeks do lose. Now, there were actually more than 300. There was a larger group, significantly larger, but they all came to the realization they were going to lose in this battle. And Leonidas permits them to go. It actually urges them to leave. But the Thespians stick around. And there are about 700 Thespians that stay with them. And the battle takes place at Thermopylae, right here. And here is, you can't quite see, this is the modern shoreline. And so when you stand here and look out the way, this doesn't look like anything, you know, this is nothing narrow. But if you read Yamauchi in his book, he says that the distance between the hill and the shoreline and marshes and all of that, of course the marshes are always a hazard. The distance is about 15 meters. So you're looking at maybe 20 feet. So it's not much width at all. And the Persian army is trying to sandwich through this in order to get south. And so this little band of Greeks is going to stand here, 1,000. Okay, a little band of Greeks is going to stand here and hold them off. Now, they're going to lose. And they apparently know they're going to lose. But they are trying to hold back the Persian army so the Greeks otherwise can rally their forces and figure out how to defend themselves. As you visit the site, it's really a fascinating one. This is the hill on which they took their last stand. And Herodotus talks about this, a very interesting discussion. And in the excavation of the site, they found this huge flurry of arrowheads. Now, certainly, a lot of these would not have been preserved for whatever reason, people plundering them, people coming along and digging, carting them off, and all that kind of stuff. But there are dozens and dozens of arrowheads. And in the description of Herodotus, he talks about, you know, we're going to fight you in the shade of the arrows as they're coming in and cascading. And the Persians ended up surrounding the Greeks and just shooting them from all sides. And of course, they did lose. But it became a huge rallying point. You know, sometimes the defeat becomes a rallying point. Similar to what happened in 9/11. The humiliation that we face became a circumstance within which we rise to the occasion. Or you think in terms of the bombing of Pearl Harbor. We rise to the occasion. And the Greeks do exactly that. Now the Persians proceed after this victory into, oh, here's the monument that is across the way. The shoreline would have been right behind the monument. And this is the monument that is set up in honor of the 300 Spartans, which, by the way, it's interesting, the Persians watching the Greeks from afar looked at them and they were out there nude, combing their long, lavish hair. The Spartans were known for their strange military strategies. They just looked at this like a bunch of idiots out here, but they did manage to hold off the Persians so that the rest of the Greek mainland could rally in support. The Persians do finally go into Athens, and while they are there, they destroy this structure that is in the foreground of the Erechtheion. Most people, when they go to Greece and go to the Parthenon, never really look at this. Because you walk in, the first thing you see on the right is the Parthenon, a really grand structure, and over here on the left is the Erechtheion. Two magnificent structures that are very imposing and inevitably in art history classes. You remember your art history classes? Oh, great. I won't tell the art department that. But the art history classes inevitably will talk about the grandeur of the Parthenon and the beauty and the delicacy of the Erechtheion. But between the two is this structure of the old temple to Athena, which the Persians destroyed. That, again, is one of those humiliating defeats that the Athenians felt. Now, they also destroyed the other Parthenon that was also in construction. And they leveled it to its lower levels. They were actually in the process of building another structure. So they build the old Parthenon. They destroy the old Parthenon while they're building then the other Parthenon. The Persians destroy both of them. So finally, when the Greeks get back and they finally build the Parthenon, and here's a view of it from the east side. One of the things that the Greeks do is they honor their victory over the Persians. Now, mind you, I have a lot of respect for the contributions the Greek people have made to Western civilization. I don't agree with everything that they've contributed, but I certainly have to give a lot of recognition for their philosophy, for their language, for their medicine, for their math, for their sciences, I mean, a host of things that they have contributed, artwork and so forth. But I sometimes facetiously say, if it hadn't been for the Persians, the Greeks wouldn't have much to talk about. Because they're always building monuments and talking about, we defeated the Persians. Now, admittedly, the Greek people have been oppressed on a number of occasions. If you listen to the stories of Hitler's German Third Reich in World War II, it is horrifying to hear some of the stories that they will tell about how the Germans treated them. But the Persians are still, memories die hard in this part of the world, as we well know. And it's still a problem that is confronting. Footnote here, I'm convinced part of the issue is that part of the world doesn't really know what forgiveness is. I think forgiveness and the forgiveness in Jesus has a lot to do with how all of this should unfold. But that's sort of a foreign concept. And people just hang on to these memories and allow them to fuel. Pardon my sermonizing, but I did preach full time for 25 years before moving to Harding. This is the portrayal that many think is actually representing the defeat of the Persians. And this would be a series of reliefs that would be on the top of the wall inside. There would be the wall, the columns, and then another wall in here, and at the top of the wall is where these reliefs were. And you can see many of these in the British Museum and reproductions of them, many of them at least, in Athens today. There is an argument about what all these mean, but that's inevitable. That's the way academics are. We always got to have a job. So we'll argue about anything. And now, back to the book of Esther. When Ahasuerus returns, the Bible talks, if you remember, that you look at your chronology there. The Greeks are defeated then ultimately at Salamis in the naval battle. And then Ahasuerus returns home, and Esther becomes queen in 479, 478 B.C., and some have suggested maybe part of what Ahasuerus is doing is sort of soothing his battle wounds with his harem. Now, I can sort of imagine that, and it makes some good sense because he has been soundly defeated by the Greeks, and he is certainly, he goes back home as a whipped puppy, if you will, and now he needs to find some solace before he can rally himself back to any significance. The Bible talks about Haman coming along, and he is trying to, you know, he gets angry at Mordecai for Mordecai's refusal to bow. I don't know how much all of this arrogance of Haman plays into how he might be just otherwise viewing the Jews. But clearly Mordecai is insubordinate, at least as far as Haman is concerned. And so he's going to use that as sort of a touch point and a spark plug to take it out on the Jewish people at large. And the Bible talks about him casting Pur to find out what day would be most suitable for his extermination, his genocide of the Hebrew people. Now, interestingly, we don't know the mechanics of casting Pur. The ancient world cast Pur, cast lots a lot, pardon the pun there. And it was a very common strategy by which decisions would be made. And we don't have any standardized strategy that is described. In the Assyrian world, even the names of the years were determined by casting lots, so that there would be names of individuals inscribed on little cubes, and then I guess it, as far as we know, that they would be drawn out of the hat, if you will, and then the respective names. So the kings were, and the years were named after administrators in the kingdom. So that if we were doing the same kind of thing today, when did Barack Obama become president? I almost said king. Sorry. When?
6 years ago.
I need a number. 2009. Okay. So 2009 might be the year of Barack. And then the next year might be the year of Holder. And then the next year might be the year of Michelle. And then the next year would, you know, on down the line. So the names, these are eponyms. The names of the years would be named after administrators in the royal court. And that's how the Assyrians would name things, and they would use these pur as strategies by which to identify the potential names of the years. Out of all of the dozens and hundreds of these that would have been used, there's only one that's ever been found. And that's a picture of it right there. And there is a reproduction over on the table over there. Full-size reproduction of that pur, which I think is in the Yale Library or Yale Museum. I'm not absolutely certain about that. But whether this is the way the pur was lot or the pur was cast for determining what date should be the day of the genocide of all the Hebrews or not is not clear. But the Bible does talk then a decree being sent out with the royal signet. And this is a ring belonging to Xerxes that might have been used to seal that document and show its officialness. Here is a reproduction of a bulla from another of his seals that could have been used as the seal impression. Obviously, it's not that one, but the king may well have had multiple seals. And the idea, of course, is to show the officialness of this decree and that everybody then should submit to this will. Now, how willing everybody would be to go out and just kill all the Jews wholesale is open to question. But that is the goal that Haman has in mind. And of course, what he's attempting to do is to harvest, I'm sure, the revenue of the Hebrew people as they might be scattered around the country in order to bring it into the wares and the wealth of the kingdom. Now, these are some, he offers basically, and there's an ambiguity as to whether he's offering or asking for, the equivalent of 333 tons of silver. I don't know about you, but that's a lot of silver. I wouldn't mind having one of those, but I don't. Now, I do have one of these, two of these, actually, and I think I'm not sure if it's over there. Okay, it's in my office still, all right. See, all kinds of things happen today. But these are 5.4 grams. These are known as sigloi. And they're silver coins. And the gold ones are the official standard that would be used by the Persians. And they're basically derived out of Sardis. And that seems to be the major mint of the ancient world. There are gold mines and streams with gold there at Sardis. And this is part of the reason why the Persians wanted to capture Sardis and go that far west. So they have this revenue. Now, Yamauchi talks about, and he cites all of these sources, Arrian, Plutarch, Diodorus, and Curtius, and they talk about the plunder that Alexander finds at Susa when he captures the palace at Susa, ranging from 40,000 to 50,000 talents of silver and gold. Now, the talent then of 40,000 would come out to 1,300 tons of gold and silver. That's impressive. This also can explain why the kings, whether it's Cyrus or Darius or Xerxes, comes along and said, when the Hebrew people go back home, we will give you all of this revenue. Because you look at the amount that they offer to Zerubbabel and the amount that they offer to Ezra and Nehemiah, it is an exorbitant sum. And it's just a paltry amount out of their resources. And of course, they're actually hoping to get it replaced with revenue that would be accruing from the outlying areas. And I'm going to talk more about Nehemiah and sort of the strategic implications of what's going on there in the next session. Now, when Haman comes along and he wants to hang Mordecai, the Bible talks about these gallows 75 cubits high. I mean, it's just huge. We probably should understand impalement in the sense that you have portrayed here with this guy impaled. I don't know why his head is sticking straight up. I have a hunch if I were impaled at all, my head would be down. I don't think I would be standing erect like that. But he is impaled. Notice the other individuals, their hands are cut off, their feet are cut off. The Assyrian, this is Assyrian, and this is from the Balawat door bands from the Assyrian kingdom. But you, here you have, and probably most of you have seen this as well, this is the portrayal of the crucifixion, the impalement of people from Lachish under the rule of Sennacherib. And probably the Persians are taking over the same kind of thing. So when he talks about a 75-foot gallows, he's probably talking about a, up on some stand with a pole at the top, and Mordecai then suspended up there so that everybody would be able to see him. Now, of course, when all of this unfolds, the tables are turned, and Haman is the one who's going to be impaled. It's not a pretty sight. And that brings me to the end of the Esther discussion. We have a few minutes left. Are there any questions or comments before I might do something else?
The concubines, Esther, and all the rest of the women that were there, they weren't his wives yet? Or was he...
Until the night of their encounter?
The fact
that they're brought into the royal court makes them his concubines. But you have the transition from the virgins, their night with the king, and then they go to the official harem where they are a concubine. And so the two aren't mixing. But as long as they're even in the auspices of the king, they would still be considered concubine because they're going to have their night with the king. And nobody, this is one reason you have eunuchs that are over there taking care of them, to try to make sure nothing inappropriate happens. Any other questions? All right, I've got a captive audience for 5 minutes. Let me show some pictures. Go ahead, Jonathan. It's after this. We haven't even got to him, and I only brought that in because of Alexander's conquest of Susa, but that's 100-plus years later, and we're not even going to go there. What did we do last session?
This is an antique.
It does have an antique license on the back. Yeah. Let me go back and try to catch up with some of the pictures for some of you who were, most of you who were in that last session. Okay. It's moving past the toilet. All right. The Royal Road, Conquest, Cyrus Cylinder. Oh, there, okay, there's the brick that I was talking about with the impression of Cyrus. There's, of course, the Ziggurat of Ur. There are the routes. Here's the caravan picture that I was showing, that I was talking about. I didn't get to show it to you. But there's the caravan with the donkeys and the camels. I don't know where this is. Probably around 1900. But this is a photograph, so it would be after cameras get on the scene, which is around generally 1870 or so. There's the rubble at Bet Shemesh that I was talking about, the bricks that have fallen, and we dig through all of this, and I was using this as sort of an example of the kind of rubble destruction that the Israelites would have confronted. Here's an altar reconstruction from Beersheba, and this is the platform area that I was talking about that you can tell the footprint of the altar at Dan. And so the Israelites would have been to figure out where the altar was at Jerusalem, and they rebuild the altar, and then they begin offerings. Yes?
Now, when they rebuilt the altar in Jerusalem, did they again cover it in gold, or was that not?
Probably did, but I don't know. The descriptions of the temple of Zerubbabel are very sparse. Herod's is much more extensive. So how much overlap and so forth there are. Now, this is the tree from Cedar of Lebanon. There's the harbor at Joppa with some shoals out there. These are the beams out of the Al-Aqsa Mosque that I was chatting about. And these are the beams just a few years ago when they were seen. And now they've been squirreled away because the Islamic Waqf don't want any study of this dealing with the Bible. Yes, these are they.
They were hard to get to. Where were they?
They would be up in Lebanon.
Yeah, but I mean, are they up in
the high elevation. Okay. Yeah, they're high elevation trees, sort of typical of evergreens. Here is the gate at Megiddo, and you'll notice one of the things I wanted to do on this one was to show See this line right here? This is a reconstruction line. You look above it, and the construction is not as nice as down here. And you have that episode in the reestablishment of the foundation when the people are crying and rejoicing, and you can't tell who is what, who's happy, who's not. And the older folk who remember the grandeur of the earlier temple recognize that the newer construction doesn't measure up to the older construction. This is sort of what I was trying to show on this that I never could show you. Admittedly, this looks reasonable enough, but this is the old ancient stuff. This is from 1300 BC, and this is from, you know, 4 years ago kind of stuff. And this is the reconstruction line. You'll also see the boards that I was talking about, the wood that comes along. This is at Dan. There's the inset at Dan. Let me go back to this one. You can see the inset here where the wood is supposed to be. And so I was talking about the cedars being used, and there's me standing in the gate at Megiddo. The offer to help, the people come down. These are the list of kings that I was talking about. Jeroboam, the son of Nevat, sort of sets the standard for wickedness. He's the benchmark of evil, I refer to him as. And Shallum and Hoshea don't have this assessment, but if you read their accounts, they certainly fit into the category of what otherwise the text consistently says. This is the reading of Sargon's decree. Now, these are the list of names, of theophoric names, at that cave dealing with Alexander, and this would be a result of the infusion of all of this idolatrous practice. And now we're in new territory. All right. Sorry for those of you who didn't go to the last one. This is a tail end because the projector busted. Okay, so I only have like a minute left anyway. The risk of religious contamination. Zerubbabel refuses their help. Ezra and Nehemiah will later refuse their help and demand separation from mixed marriages. And the risk here is not they're trying to be mean. The risk is they've learned their lesson than the risk of syncretistic influences. And they want to try to maintain a purity. This is the behavior that had characterized Judah and Israel before the exile. And they did not want to repeat it. And that had precipitated the exile of both Israel and Judah, even to the point in the description of both of these that Israel and Judah behaved worse than the Canaanites were before Israel even arrived. And that's a big deal. And the Israelites had finally learned this lesson. So why should they assume that if we fraternize with these idolatrous folks, why should we assume it's going to be any different? So they just refuse the assistance. Because inevitably, when people work with you, they want to have a vested interest in what you're doing. Bell rang again. Thank you.